prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror films, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica.
And before we get into this episode's movie, The Strangler, Erica, you took a trip to Philadelphia to catch the return of X-Fest.
I did, yeah. So X-Fest is put on by Exhumed Films. It's back after a two-year hiatus because of COVID. And at the Colonial Theater, which is where the original Blob was filmed, and they fully embrace it. You know, they're like, they have Blob Fest, and like almost every store on their like main street has something in reference to the Blob. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I won't get into the movies watched there because our friends over at Twitch of the Death Nerve have a full episode about all the movies. So you should definitely go and check that out. But it was nice, you know, not just, you know, obviously getting to spend time with John and Charles and Sam, but some other friends. And I got to meet listener Matt and his wife, Erin, in person, which was really nice.
Nice.
And so for folks who aren't, well, you obviously, if you're listening, you're a podcast listener. But if you're also a reader, Matt wrote did a write-up on X-Fest on his blog, Kino Ventura. So you can check that out. I'll put a link to that in show notes for folks.
Awesome.
It was a lot of fun. I will say that probably I will talk about one film, and it was the first one. And highly, highly, highly recommend this one. It's called High Risk, and it's like a suburban dad heist movie. And it's got James Brolin, Bruce Davidson, and Anthony Quinn. James Coburn is in it, kind of for like a hot minute. And then
Cleavon Little.
And Cleavon Little from Blazing Saddles is in it. And it's really fun. Lulls a little bit in the middle, but the ending, this is like such a great movie to see with a crowd because there's a real star of the movie who I didn't mention. And like their part in the ending, like the whole crowd just like lost their mind.
Yeah, I think I know who you didn't name. And as soon as I saw you and a lot of people I follow in Letterboxd log this, I read about it. Saw it was on Tubi.
Yes, it is on Tubi.
Yeah, so it's on my watch list, and I can't wait to check it out.
Yeah, so I know by the time this comes out, Junesploitation is pretty much wrapping up. Mm-hmm. But if you just need a last minute addition in there, throw that one in. You'll have a great time with it. So
yeah, use it as a free space or what something. Year is it? Like 90s action, or I guess it's 80s.
I think it's either late 70s or early 80s. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. So they're doing their 24-hour horrorthon, same location. I'm probably not going to go to that because just 12 hours is kind of rough.
Are you planning to go to X-Fest in the future?
I think so, yeah. And nice. Also, Charles was asking if you were going to come.
Oh.
Because he's like, I want to meet Lance.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I should, you know, me in baseball, I'm already thinking like, I wonder if the Phillies have a game or something.
Oh my God.
I got to look at the schedule for next season. They're balancing out the schedule. So there's going to be, I'm going to get a baseball nerdy, but there's going to be a lot of AL, American League and National League schedule changes. Like they'll be playing each other more, mm-hmm. interleague play. So what if the Astros were in town during X-Fest? We could go to X-Fest.
What is this we? Well, we could go to X-Fest.
Yeah, I mean,
okay, I'm not going to the
I don't have a turd in my pocket. I'm talking about you.
Okay. All right.
And we go and watch out. Like it could be a 4-game series. We stay for a week.
Wait, I'm not going to a baseball game.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I saw that Charles and Sam went to one earlier in the season. Do they like baseball?
I don't. Nobody likes baseball as much as you, Lance.
Well, it's not about just like sitting and watching the game. It's about the experience and the ambiance and the wieners and the buns.
I mean,
and
I'll think about it just because of the wieners. So okay. I'll think about it. We'll leave it at that.
Well, X-Fest sounds like a blast.
It was.
And that's cool that Charles asked because now I'm really considering it.
Okay, good.
just to watch the movies, nothing else. Okay. So let's jump into Bert Topper's The Strangler, released in 1964.
The Strangler, based on the terrifying crime wave that has gripped Boston and spread across the country.
That makes number 8 for The Strangler.
Yeah, it looks that way.
Starring Victor Buono. The shock sensation of whatever happened to Baby Jane as the most baffling, the most horrifying criminal in a decade.
Girl wasn't raped. No evidence of maltreatment after death.
No woman is safe as long as the Strangler lives and roams at will.
There are a lot of people who don't laugh at me anymore. They don't laugh at anybody.
A strange, shocking being of unpredictable emotions. No one knows when or where he will strike again.
As of this recording, The Strangler has 468 views on Letterboxd. It's currently streaming on Tubi, and I think you can find it on YouTube or Internet Archive or something out there. And when I recently logged in on Letterboxd, I don't know, within the last week, I did see a few people that I follow and who listen to the podcast log it.
Yeah.
You know, after we announced it on our Blu-ray wishlist episode. So Adam, Robert, thanks for listening and watching.
They're getting ahead of the game.
They are, yes. And for those of you who haven't watched it, here's a short summary. This is one of those movies that you can't really spoil, in my opinion. It's a 1960s thriller. You kind of know it's going to...
Well, you know who the killer is from the beginning, so...
Right.
Yeah. It's just a matter of, like, how and when he'll get caught.
Yeah.
That's really it.
It's a standard plot. I mean, it's all about watching the performances.
Exactly.
And, I mean, it all starts with Victor Buono, who plays the Strangler, Leo Kroll, who, like Erica said, within the first few minutes of the movie, he's strangling his 8th victim. And after killing his victims, sometimes he leaves dolls at the scene, sometimes stripping them naked, throwing them against the wall. He gets most of these dolls from a carnival funhouse type place called the Fun Palace, where he goes to play this ring toss game to win dolls. And he goes to the Fun Palace every few weeks to see a young woman named Tally, who he's infatuated with. And there's no real proven reason why Leo loves strangling women, but the cops and the psychiatrist on the murder case think it's likely due to a deep hatred for his mother, which the script leans heavily into because Leo's mom, she's in an assisted living facility and clearly has a controlling role over Leo. She seems to have been a terrible mother to him his whole life. So the Strangler is mostly Leo adding to his kill count, while the police do a terrible job trying to catch him. You know, there's scenes where he asks Tally to marry him. She refuses. And if you refuse a proposal from a strangler, you kind of know what's next.
Right.
Again, it's an early 60s thriller, so you can probably guess how it all ends. But, you know, we'll be chatting about the ending and specific plot points. But again, it's all about the performances, the cast. Victor Buono. I've never seen this man put in a bad performance.
No. I mean, even in a movie that I did not understand or care for.
Right. I mean, that we'll get. Yeah, this movie's on the list. I have a lot of his credits listed here.
Yeah.
I mean, he's amazing as Leo Kroll, the Strangler. He's amazing in everything I've seen him in. Most notably, he's probably most recognized in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Robert Aldrich's film, where Buono plays Edwin Flagg, the hired pianist, who's helping Jane revive her old act. And he actually earned an Oscar and a Golden Globe Best Supporting Actor nomination for that role. And that's such a great movie. It's a movie I always should rewatch, but
yeah,
I just don't.
I meant to revisit it before this, but because it's been a really long time. But yeah, so good.
Yeah, it's Aldrich too, so they're kind of long. Most of his movies are over 2 hours.
Yeah.
Which are good. It's worth spending that time, but
yeah,
not in June exploitation.
Not this month. No, next month.
I did rewatch Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, though, another Aldrich from 1964. Buono is again with Bette Davis, and he's playing her father, Big Sam Hollis. He kind of has a role like his mother in The Strangler, where he's kind of controlling. Mm-hmm. And so that was interesting. Then he was in another Aldrich film called Four for Texas, a Western comedy starring Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Anita Ekberg. Mm-hmm. The Three Stooges and a young Charles Bronson also make an appearance. So I kind of want to check that out. Buono plays, quote, Fat Man in the sequel to The Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes from 1970. And he does an amazing job playing the devil in the Roger Corman produced The Evil.
Yeah.
That's like a shot. I mean, we should probably pull that and post that on social media, because when he does his transformation, mm-hmm. it's like wild.
Looking. Yeah.
One of my favorite performances of his is he plays a newspaper editor in Albert DeMartino's The Man with Icy Eyes from 1971. Mm-hmm. So that one is on YouTube. I had never seen it before, but I was watching it. I watched it for this episode. It stars Antonio Sabato and Barbara Boucher.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know how you like Antonio Sabato. Mm-hmm.
So. I do.
Oh, you really do? Okay. He's good.
Not the junior.
I thought, not the junior. Yeah, no. I got it. That when I think of Antonio Sabato Jr. now, I think of that Henry. Yeah. Antonio Sabato Jr. played Henry Lee Lucas, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay, so other notable films of Victor Buono's that I haven't seen, the 3.5 hour long The Greatest Story Ever Told from 1965.
Yeah, I've never bit the bullet and watched that one.
Yeah, that's the story about the life of Jesus, who's played by Max von Sydow. Another comedy Buono's in with, again, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, along with Sammy Davis Jr., Bing Crosby, Peter Falk, Robin and the Seven Hoods, where Bruno plays the deputy sheriff. This seems to have good ratings, so I kind of want to check that out too. And then there's a movie from 1974 called Moonchild. Okay. Erica, I watched this last night. Mm-hmm. Before we recorded this, I started watching this like at midnight.
Oh my God, what's wrong with you?
And it's because I was on Letterboxd and saw you had logged it. And your review actually made me want to watch it.
Yeah. Another person who follows me on Letterboxd commented the same thing. He's like, this reads like an endorsement. And I'm like, how? I'm super confused by this movie.
I mean, I love confusing plots, movies that don't make sense.
Sure. But like,
yeah, this is next level.
Yeah. So I read one review on there who someone mentioned student film, and I didn't like look into it just to verify if that was true. But if it is, then it makes sense.
I read that too, and I had to check it out too. And apparently, so it's categorized as an independent horror, new age student film, a master thesis project at the University of Southern California. It was originally shot in 1971. It was directed by Alan Gadney. Mm-hmm. Not only was your review like kind of like, okay, I guess I'm going to watch this, you know, at 1 a.m. in the morning. But the plot is wild. I just want to read it to everybody because this is a film. I mean, you can't recommend it, but it is a weird, weird viewing experience. So a young man, the Moonchild, is reincarnated every 25 years, with each life ending in a stay at a mission hotel. Then he meets characters from his first life, all of whom are doomed to relive their roles in his life and death as well. The cycle will end when his spirit reaches a state of perfection by purging its negative, violent impulses. Actor John Carradine is the walker of the world, an otherworldly poet who is there to observe and record for posterity the proceedings.
So that's
what it was. I got it all. When I was watching it, I was like, I could have wrote that summary.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, I was thinking to myself as I was watching it, and it was, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, I was like, I blame Erica for this.
How dare you?
But then I thought I should blame myself because she watched it because Victor Buono's in it.
Right.
And my pick was The Strangler. So this is my fault.
Yes. Also, my review is not a ringing endorsement of the film. I was literally like scratching my head. Don't get it. Moving on. Like, just
your review was better worded, and it was intrigued. Let me read it real quick. Right. Scratch his head, looks at dog for answers, nothing. Shrug shoulders and turns off Tubi.
that was my experience with the movie.
I was like, watch list. You know what? No, I'm gonna watch it now. And I did it. I'm gonna say pair it with Born of Fire to lose your fucking marbles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll see that one. Yeah. That one is pretty loose on plot too, but like that one is at least much more visually interesting.
It is. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Moonchild feels like a student film. What's impressive about it is the cast, the actors that this Alan Gaddy was able to get.
I mean, anyone could get John Carradine at this point. So, I mean.
Yeah. And Victor Buono, which I'm going to get into, he was really into like the college and university scene, like doing some tours and stuff with his spoken word stuff.
Yeah. He's like, I watched some YouTube videos of him reading his poetry and he's going on tour with like that. And like his poetry is very, either spoken word or kind of limericky.
I travel and I'll be doing a lot of colleges, but I keep in touch. I watch the show. And did I hear you say something one night about the effects of marijuana on the
I was reporting, I guess we did a thing in the news, in the newspaper, that they found that heavy cigarette smoking among males, strangely enough, among men, increased the size of the breasts in males. It was in the newspaper.
I take your word.
An unusual, usual item.
I have recently heard a discouraging word from a source which, of course, can be trusted, that he who smokes pot risks arrest if he's caught, and he also runs the risk of being busted. If it's true that the weed swells men's bosoms indeed if they smoke it without moderation, then I'd like to say that's a great price to pay in return for a cheap titillation. Now, many won't believe a word. They say it's utterly absurd, a wily way of playing on men's fears. Perhaps we'll all believe our eyes when Playboy starts to advertise the Johnny Carson line of men's brassieres. So smoke a plain old cigarette. Don't booby-trap your silhouette. You needn't be the same as all the rest. Go make the best of it. Make a clean breast of it. Be a man and get things off your chest.
It's interesting.
Yeah, Buono is great. I mean, like I said, everything I've watched him in, I've loved.
I watched some clips of him as King Tut on the Batman show too.
I think a lot of people like the original Batman series. He plays the villain King Tut, which I remember watching. You know, not like in the 60s.
Well, we're not that old yet, but yes, the reruns.
But he played the villain in 10 episodes from 66 to 68. He had numerous roles in other television series: Perry Mason, The Wild Wild West. He played Christopher Lloyd's father in the Taxi series. I think it was only like one or two episodes.
Okay, I'm not going
to remember. It seemed to be a storyline from what I read, but he passed away. Buono passed away. So they weren't able to like, they'd made an episode where Christopher Lloyd was dealing with the death of his father.
Okay.
So his last film credit was providing the voice to a talking wolf in the animated fantasy adventure, The Flight of the Dragons. Have you seen that?
I have not.
That was released in 1982, directed by Jules Bass and Arthur Rankin Jr., who did a bunch of those, Frosty the Snowman, all Rankin those classics. Bass, yeah. I think James Earl Jones and John Ritter provided a voice. I added that to my watch list, too. I like animated movies for the most part. So Buono died on January 1st, 1982, at the age of 43. You know, they ruled it a heart attack. He was found alone in his home New Year's Day. He was a heavyset man, looking older than his age. Although I think he had childish features.
He's got a very childish face.
Yeah, especially his eyes.
Yeah, but the thing about it too is that, you know, he owned it really well. Like he not just like as a stage presence, but in his comedy routines, like that was kind of always like the subject of his jokes and things like that. A lot of them haven't aged well, obviously.
But, yeah.
I mean, he was making fun of himself, and he took it really well when like Johnny Carson would like take a jab at him, because it was probably a joke he'd already said about himself anyway. So
yeah, there is a great he was on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and that's actually what. So he did record a comedy album, or it's more like there's a live audience. I listened to it. I listened to some of it while I was putting together some show notes, and. You know, like you said, it's very dated. It's called Heavy.
Yeah.
And it's all about his size. It's all about, he just focuses on his eating habits and stuff like that. I mean, his performances on stage, his performances on these recordings, his performances in film all kind of revolved around his size. I mean, he played a lot of villainous roles because of his size. Mm-hmm. His lifelong ambition, that what I had read, was to be on Broadway. He did get a lot of Shakespearean roles in theater in his early career, but his lifelong dream was to be on Broadway. And he was scheduled to appear on Broadway the spring of 1982, which is just months before he passed away.
Yeah.
He had a role, but he actually reminds me of another heavy set actor from the 40s who also died young. He died at 31. Laird Krieger. He was in Hangover Square, the 1944 Lodger.
Oh,
where he plays the Ripper. This Gun for Hire, I Wake Up Screaming. Like years ago, I got into watching a lot of 40s films. And when I came across him, I kind of sought out all his performances. Mm-hmm. And he's just completely captivating. And when I started watching more Victor Buono movies, they had the same effect on me. They were just both captivating, large, heavy set men who just stole scenes.
Yeah. I will say he was the best part of Moonchild.
Yeah.
At least for me.
No, I agree. 100%. It definitely wasn't the lead student.
Oh, my God. No.
So we already, Victor Buono, he was like a poet in a riot. He did record that album Heavy, which he recites written jokes, poems. It actually charted because of the Tonight Show performance, which is good.
Yeah.
Where he performed his Fat Man's Prayer. It's on YouTube. Like I said, he took that performance for his album to colleges around the U.S. in the 70s. When I was listening to it, I felt kind of sad a little bit about it, especially after watching The Strangler, because, you know, The Strangler's kind of, his mom is very mean to him, yells at him that tells him he's fat, you know, the women don't like him. And that is kind of like the catalyst that turns him into The Strangler.
Yeah.
So it's sad in that regard, but it's like his lyrical presentation, like you said, of it, the syntax and his timing he uses. I mean, he was a pro. He treated his performances as a poet. I don't know if I'd recommend listening to his record. I would, because it is funny. I mean, he's clearly having fun with it. But yeah, definitely Google search like his performances, his interviews, because he's a very smart comedian, writer.
He's very charismatic too.
Yeah.
Like his intonations and just listening to him talk is just captivating.
Yeah. He's just a performer through and through.
Yeah.
I mean, he passed away far too young. So Victor Buono, this is what The Strangler is. It's all about his performance.
Yeah.
I mean, let's get real. But there are other cast members. It's not just Victor Buono. Ellen Corby plays his mom, Mrs. Kroll. She had a lot of smaller roles in some great films. Hitchcock's Vertigo, It's a Wonderful Life, Billy Wilder's Sabrina. She had a small part in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. But she was in a lot of Westerns, Gunfighter, Shane. She had almost 300 television and film acting credits. She was in the Lassie TV series. And her big role was Grandma Walton in the Waltons series.
Oh, okay.
Which I never watched, but, you know, she was in over 100 episodes. She was also a screenwriter, which was which is impressive for that period.
Yeah.
She wrote episodes of The Waltons, and she also wrote a few Western films.
Yeah.
Then we have Dave McLean, who plays Lieutenant Frank Benson, who's one of the many bumbling cops in this thing.
Yeah.
Small roles that I found: Kingdom of the Spiders, the Corman produced Death Sport, Nevada Smith, starring the dreamy Steve McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
Just small character roles. Davey Davidson plays Tally, the woman Buono is kind of obsessed with. I think this was her first role, but looking at her credits, she didn't act for too long. She was in a comedy called Marriage on the Rocks. Then there are more cops and strangled victims in the cast, but there's one character, Clara, the nurse who takes care of Mrs. Kroll.
Mm-hmm.
She's played by Jean Bates, who acted in a few dozen films that I've seen, and really, I was kind of impressed with the movies that she's been in. They're small parts, but she was in David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. She played Charlotte Stewart's mother, Mrs. X, in David Lynch's Eraserhead, 1977.
Oh, yeah, okay.
She was in Die Hard 2, Silent Night, Deadly Night, Lou Lander's Return of the Vampire. And she starred in a horror film that I had on my possible list for an episode for a while,
mm-hmm.
Mom, from 1991.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Directed by Patrick Rand. It's about the werewolf mom.
Yeah, I know.
She plays the mom, Emily Dwyer. So it's probably passed 1,000 views on Letterboxd.
Thank fucking God.
But it is worth checking out if you guys mm-hmm. want to check it out. I think it's on Tubi, if I remember. And for the crew. So The Strangler is directed by Bert Topper. He has 8 directing credits, all of which he wrote except for The Strangler. So Topher got started as a director with AIP, mm-hmm. American International Pictures, which was a production company founded in 1954 by the great Samuel Z. Arkoff and James H. Nicholson. And there's a cool documentary that I saw you watched.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd been meaning to, it just been sitting in my Tubi watch list. Like it was all the way at the end of it because it'd been in there for so long. And I was like, oh, I'm going to finally watch that.
Yeah, I watched it too. It's cool. It's like an hour long narrated.
It could have been a lot longer though.
Oh yeah. It's a quick history of AIP.
Yeah.
But it flows. There's a lot of talking heads. Bert Topper, the director for The Strangler, is a talking head. Mm-hmm. He looked to me like an old Johnny Cash.
Yes. Thank you. God, I was trying to place it. I was like, he looks like someone.
But it's narrated by Peter Bogdanovich. It's good. It's worth watching. Like it's under, or it might be like 64 minutes or something. So all of Topper's first films were all under the AIP production label. His first was Hell Squad from 1958, mm-hmm. About five American soldiers getting lost in Tunisia during World War II. You watched it.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's boring. Yeah. It's fine.
It's if you think about what it is, like it's filmed over a weekend. Yeah. They're like on some like army base kind of thing. Like it's very stripped down. But if you're going to have a movie that's very stripped down like that and not a whole lot happens, you need to have really interesting characters. And a couple of them are kind of interesting, but it's 2.5 stars. Like it's just there.
Fine. It's shot on 16mm. I think it looks great. It's mm-hmm. black and white.
Yeah.
Like you said, record on the week is no budget. But yeah, the characters are a lot of first time actors and stuff in it. And you can kind of, it definitely kind of showed.
Yeah.
Or it definitely did show, I should say. So Topper followed that up with another war drama under AIP called Tank Commandos, 1959. I didn't watch that one, did you?
Nope.
Then he directed The Diary of a High School Bride about a 17-year-old high school senior marrying a 20-something law student. No. Mm. Another war drama called War is Hell. So Bert Topper, he served in the U.S. Navy. In real life during World War II. So mm-hmm. he probably wrote all these stories from, you know, experience in a mental place. But this is a kind of interesting, I found this interesting about War is Hell when I was looking this up. It was released in 1962, and apparently it was playing at the Texas Theater in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963.
Uh-oh.
Lee Harvey Oswald snuck into the theater and watched it before being arrested. I think the wording was snuck. He probably bought a ticket. I don't know. Maybe he just...
I don't know. Do people who assassinate presidents buy movie tickets?
Yeah, maybe it was, that probably slipped his mind. He's probably focused on something mm-hmm, else.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe Bert Topper set the creepy guy's mind at ease for a bit before getting
arrested. Not enough.
Okay, moving on. Topper then directed The Strangler, which is not an AIP film, by the way. After The Strangler, The Devil's Eight, mm-hmm. starring the great Christopher George, which you watched.
I did.
How was that?
You know, after I watched it, I was like, it's fine. It's, you know, it's basically a Dirty Dozen ripoff.
Yeah.
But Christopher George can carry a movie like nobody's business. And it's not a great movie, but the score is literally still stuck in my head.
Oh, nice.
And it's been, I think, a week since I watched it. And it's just very catchy, and they play it a lot.
It's a song with lyrics and stuff?
No, it's just the score.
It's a theme,
itself.
Like a
theme,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I'm gonna check it out. That one, I think that one was on Tubi too.
Yeah, most of his stuff is on Tubi or YouTube.
I did see one from a little bit earlier. He didn't direct it, but he narrated a documentary called Sadismo. And it was a documentary about torture, cruelty, and exotic practices around the world.
Oh.
And I was going to watch this because I was like, well, that shit sounds up my alley. But then I watched the trailer and I saw it mentioned killing and skinning a bear. So I did not watch it.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah.
And then I watched this movie, which he followed up with The Devil's Eight, The Hard Ride in 1971. It's about a Vietnam soldier who promises a dying friend that he'll take care of his motorcycle, which the motorcycle's name is Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets back home. He ends up falling in love with the dead friend's girlfriend and dealing with a group of bikers who want Baby for themselves. So it's a really awkward, strange story. It's very cheesy. It's not as like exploitation as I was kind of hoping and that the poster hinted at. but I still kind of enjoyed it overall. The ending is completely out of the blue, completely unexpected. Like I had to rewind it like 20 seconds just to make sure I didn't miss something because it's so abrupt and you're like,
oh,
okay, that's fucking awesome. but yeah, that one's on Tubi, The Hard Ride. This is a quick watch. And then Topper's last film was Soul Hustler, also known as The Day the Lord Got Busted, released in 1973, which was apparently one of the many films that Tarantino used for inspiration when filming Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay.
It's about a whoring, pot-smoking, wandering singer who teams up with a tent show preacher to make some big money on tour. I've had this one on my watch list for a while. I think since Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, but I can't find it streaming. So Bert Topper's filmography, it's interesting, if not a bit too heavy on the war dramas.
Yeah.
But I couldn't really figure out a reason or find out why he stopped directing films. Because, you know, he passed away in 2007. I read that he was planning, like he announced in 1974 that he was going to make like 15 films. I think he said that'll be worth like $10 million or something.
Okay.
But he didn't direct another film after that, after saying that. Yeah, I mentioned The Strangler isn't an AIP-produced film. It's it was produced by Samuel Bischoff, who produced a lot of crime thrillers, Angels with Dirty Faces and Pitfall. He started producing films in the early 1920s, and The Strangler's actually his last producing credit. Bill Ballinger wrote The Strangler. He had a handful of film writing credits, but most of his work was in television, writing episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Outer Limits, Kolchak, The Night Stalker, the great Darren McGavin.
Hell yeah.
So The Strangler script is so, to me, plain. It's just basic.
Yeah.
And to me, it makes sense that Ballinger seemed to have more success writing these episodic television screens because that's kind of what the Strangler feels like, a long TV episode.
Yeah.
So The Strangler's, I think it's a beautiful black and white film. It was shot by cinematographer Jacques Marquette. His credits include A Bucket of Blood, Burnt Offerings, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, Creature from the Sea, The Last Woman on Earth. So a ton of AIP and Roger Corman productions. But I really like the look of this movie.
So. Yeah, me too.
And finally, the score. It's composed by Marlon Skiles. It's incredibly 1960s, dramatic strings, kind of standard thriller cues. It's good. It's what you'd expect from a movie like this. Other scores that Skiles did was Dead Reckoning, The Giant Claw, Queen of Outer Space with Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Sam Peckinpah's The Deadly Companions. A lot of films he scored, during the 30s through the 70s. So long career. And that's it for the cast and crew for The Strangler.
All right. We'll get more into this film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
I want to start like the film does.
Okay.
And I want to bring up that opening film crawl or that acknowledgement.
Yes.
So I'm going to read it real quick. It's short. We gratefully acknowledge the cooperation of the police departments of some of the major cities of the United States who have permitted us to examine their files and authenticate the behavior of the suspects of similar crimes. We also gratefully acknowledge the guidance of the noteworthy psychiatrists who have enabled us to reconstruct the character in accordance with their realistic experiences. Okay, so I know the intention. The producer Samuel Bischoff and David Diamond, they had originally planned to make a movie called The Boston Strangler, which was actually occurring in real life during that time. It was still an unsolved case. The Boston Strangler was loose. So they wanted to capitalize on that. So I get that their intention for like this opening acknowledgement is kind of a marketing tool, you know, to entice, maybe frighten the audience.
Sure.
You know, your coworker, your neighbor could be a serial killer, you know. It's like the stupid based on true events that a lot of horror movies do.
Right.
And it was probably more effective in 1964. But to me, this acknowledgement and watching The Strangler, it just shows how incompetent the police are.
Yeah. I'm like, it's not a ringing endorsement for them.
It is. It makes me laugh because they're claiming that they pulled like these real police files. So cops are basically like shrugging their shoulders. Like, I don't know. Like, you hand me another box of milk. And they're saying shit like, this is like a direct quote from The Strangler. After, you know, they inspect like one of the victims, somebody says, there's no sign of rape. And another cop replies, then what the hell does he get out of killing? Like, that's justification.
Right. Yeah. I wrote that one down too. And I was like, Jesus Christ.
It's fucking terrible. And they're not just saying that they, you know, they worked with real cops and police records, but they're acknowledging, quote, noteworthy psychiatrists and their realistic experiences. And there's another scene in The Strangler where this esteemed psychologist says, it's after Buono's character is given and passes a polygraph test. And he says that paranoid schizophrenics can fool lie detectors. And he starts spouting some shit about the murderer must have a deep hatred for his mother. And he must feel cheated in some way, most likely between the ages of 19 and 30, because this is the age bracket where most schizos erupt into violence. Most schizos right. erupt into violence. So I'm like, okay, this is what, I don't know. I mean, I know it was filmed when the real Boston Strangler, you know, was out there. And his real name was Albert DeSalvo, the real Boston Striker. Yeah. So I wanted to look into his childhood to see how right the psychiatrist got. And he, you know, he didn't have he had a father who was very abusive to his mother. Maybe he hated his mom. I don't know. You know, he strangled 13 women over 18 months. He was obviously fucked up, but I feel like you can't assume a man who strangles women or people to death just hates his mom. And that's the reason he's doing it.
Yeah. You could just hate women in general.
Yeah. You could just, yeah, exactly. You could have, and apparently you can fool lie detectors tests if you're a
okay. Schizo. You can fool a lie detector test, but they also like this, how bad the cops are is that it's so like, yeah, maybe he's beating like the lie detector test physically right. with his heartbeat and breathing patterns and whatever. But his mannerism while he's speaking, so clearly he's like, nope.
Yes. Nope. That's
nope. Like saying it like that, I'm like, anyone who is innocent is going to be panicking and like over explaining, like, I am not the person that you are looking for. And this guy is just sitting in there like, nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Like there, I'm sure I saw it in like in a movie or a TV show or something. And it's like the easiest way to know if someone is guilty or innocent is putting them in a jail cell overnight. A guilty person will fall asleep. An innocent person will stay wide awake because they're so like panicked about being charged with something that they didn't do.
Right.
And yeah, Leo Kroll is just sitting there just like, nope. And I like with a fucking ego off the charts. And they're like, well, he passed the lie detector test. So shrug shoulders, let him go. And yeah. I'm like, oh my God, fucking cops are so fucking stupid.
Yeah. The cops are so fucking dumb in this. And I did have that note. I love how Leo Kroll just says, nope. Mm-hmm. He must say it like, you know, at least a dozen times when he's asked questions throughout the movie. But there is a lot of time spent on the police procedural stuff and how stupid the cops are and how they're kind of doing nothing.
Yeah.
And to me, that kind of goes back to the just, I don't know, the limited script. It's basically the whole movie is him just strangling people and the cops doing nothing.
Right.
And dealing with his mom.
So getting back to like the beginning though, after that opening text crawl.
Yeah.
This movie, and we already talked about it, it is beautifully shot black and white cinematography, but it's very simplistic, much like the script. Like there's nothing really all that special going on. But the opening right after the text crawl tricked me because it's got this fantastic shot of a woman's a woman changing her reflection in the pupil of an eyeball.
Yes.
And I'm like, ooh, heck yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm settling in for like some Alfred Hitchcock,
yeah,
like great camera work. This is going to be some innovative shit.
Yeah.
That is the best shot in the movie.
It is.
Without a doubt. I think it, and I loved the last shot too. Mm-hmm. The end where it's over.
Yeah. I like that a lot too. So it bookends itself very well, but everything in the middle is the middle. You're relying completely on Buono's performance.
100%.
And yeah, if you didn't have that, you wouldn't have anything worth really watching here.
Yeah. I mean, Topper, I think, does well in the cinematographer Marquette. I think they, with the script they have, they do some pretty good stuff.
It's competent.
To me, it does feel very television. There's no nudity. There's no real, the violence is there, but it's, yeah, you know, it's subtle. I mean, it's subdued.
Yeah.
But there are some other cool shots that I did take note of. The medical examiner at the first murder. So it's just a cool, it's nothing like, you know, groundbreaking or anything, but he has like, he's kind of measuring the seam. He has his tape measure. Mm-hmm. And the camera is following the tape measure as it's being pulled out.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it starts there, pulls out, then it kind of pans across the scene of the, you know, the dead victim. And there's one dart transition scene that was really great. So just, you know, jumping around, Buono's mother is killed. He kills, mm-hmm, his mother. Well, he
indirectly.
Yeah. She has a heart attack because he basically tells her that because he killed her care, one of her caretakers or one of the nurses that helped save her life previously, Clara. And he tells her that she's dead and she's never coming back. And that kind of triggers her to have this heart attack. So it's like maybe it could be tied to him. It could be.
Yeah, I know for sure. Like he didn't do anything to try to help her. He just sat there and watched her have a heart attack.
Yeah. And there's just this great scene where, you know, he goes home and you could tell he's ready for the phone call to act surprised. Mm-hmm. And his performance is so great. He's like, you know, battling, smiling and crying and, mm-hmm, saying, I just saw my mother. You know, it's really great. And then he's kind of celebrating. He goes into her room, grabs this like jewelry box and just starts like trashing her room. Yeah. But he grabs this jewelry box and throws it against the wall. And as soon as it hits the wall, the scene cuts to the fun palace and a dart is popping a balloon.
Yeah. Good transition.
So there, you know, I feel like Topper did some cool tricks with the very minimal script that was handed to him. Cause again, this is the only movie he directed that he didn't write.
Yeah. I will say that like going back to that scene where he just, after his mom dies and he's just going around breaking shit.
Yeah.
It's no Charles Foster Kane breaking shit. Like he's, I think Buono is not much of a physical actor. And I'm not saying that because he's a heavy set man. I'm right. saying that because like his is much more like in his facial expressions and intonation and expression. Right. Him just sort of going around destroying shit. I didn't feel it like you feel like fucking Orson Welles fucking stumbling around and smash, grab. Like,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Because it is. Yeah. Victor Buono, he's a theater actor. I mean, you could just, I don't know. I mean, there's so many like notes that I have just on his performance in this. He's just like Laird Krieger, like I brought up earlier from the 40s. Mm-hmm. He's just so natural, almost like he wrote the script. Like all the dialogue he's saying, he wrote. It just feels so natural.
Yeah.
Basically, he's told, here's your character. And he just kind of develops them. And everything I've seen, which is amazing. Like when the detectives are questioning him about his 2.5 years of college, basically, you know, you didn't finish college. And he answers, I couldn't afford to complete my medical education, but I have sufficient training to be a policeman. I just, it's so witty and quick. And he is very egotistical in this.
Yeah. I like when he's being questioned at that time too, when he's asked if he lives alone and he replies, well, my mother is still alive and she, you know, she's crippled and, or she can't get up or she can't leave the house or she can't leave or go outside or something like that.
Yeah.
And as soon as he said it, he answered it that way. I was like, oh, that's going to come back later when he gets re-questioned.
Yeah. And it does.
But like the detectives are too stupid to pick up on that and say like, that's not what I asked you. I asked, you know, if you lived alone and you answered with your mother is still alive and that your dad is dead, like, yeah, fucking dumbass cops, man.
And they're like, you know, don't you think that's, you know, you're implying that you live with your mother? And he's just like, I guess, you yeah. know, it's, you didn't ask me specifically. It's, he's very just smug, and I love his performance in this. Yeah. So the dolls, mm-hmm. it leans heavily. The addition of the dolls is just, to me, it's just there. Like, it feels like something that would be like in a Law and Order TV episode, yeah. there to help solve the case.
There's one moment where I think it's after the first kill where he brings the doll home and he's stripping it off.
Pulling little pantyhose and stuff off of it.
I was like, well, that exists? Okay. Yeah. I didn't have those for my fucking Misfits dolls when I was a kid, but all right. But like, yeah, he's stripping the doll naked. And it pans up to his face and you can see him sweating and he looks like he's getting sexually aroused yes. by it. And then he just, nothing, he doesn't do it. I mean, obviously it's a 60s movie. He's not going to, they're not going to show him like, you know, like after that, but like.
Yeah. I thought it implied like necrophilia was happening. He was sleeping with the bodies.
Something. Yeah.
But
then he just tosses a doll into a drawer with like a few others. So yeah. it really, yeah, it just does become this plot device for him to get connected back to the murders.
Yeah, I just, like, I don't know. I guess dolls are kind of creepy. I mean,
I guess it's just the idea of, like, a grown man collecting them. I mean, even though he tells the girls at the carnival that he's getting them for his nieces, like,
yeah,
the fact of him just having them is supposed to show his abnormality.
Yeah, it works. I mean, it's a cool, I mean, yeah, it's needed for this movie, obviously, to wrap everything around. But
yeah.
So how he does get caught... We got to talk about the police sketch.
Oh my God. It takes.
So this is a long scene. It's an amazing scene. So the cops are there. There's a sketcher and Tally from the Fun Palace mm-hmm. who earlier, Leo Kroll went to the Fun Palace. He had just killed her friend that also worked with her. And he asked her to marry him. And she's like, I don't know you. Who are you? Know, whatever.
Right.
So that's when the cops start tying everything together, more or less, and they want her to describe this man. And so there's a cop kind of over her shoulder that just over, he just keeps saying, you know, go on, tell the sketcher, what is it? And she's like, his chin needs to be a little less sharp. Oh, that's it. Now a bit of a double chin. You got it. And the eyes are more like sunken in or whatever. There you go. And then they show the sketch and it looks more like Victor Buono than the real Victor Buono. And the cop, and there's one cop that's super pissed, and he says, it's that fat, egotistical Leo Kroll. And that is how they find out that he is the strangler when all the fucking evidence were right in front of their face the entire movie.
Yeah. Well, like, and what kills me too is like, so after they've miraculously figured it out, so the cops take... Tally. The cops take Tally back home and she's like, no, I don't need you to watch over. And I'm like, oh my God, it's when a character is dumb in order for like an event to happen, that annoys me.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, he is the strangler, you know, he's killed women, you know, you upset him. Like, and so she's like, no, you don't need to stay. A cop goes with her to the apartment. He plants a microphone, but then he leaves. And I get it. Like, she wants him out of the apartment. Stay right outside the fucking door. But no, he goes all the way back downstairs to sit in the cop car with his partner so they can both listen in.
Yeah.
Cops are so fucking stupid. My God. Because then, so then when they're like, oh, he's in the apartment or they can't hear any noise coming from the microphone.
Right.
All the way back up, like multiple flights of stairs to get there and barely rescue her in time. And I know it's there for like tension or whatever. But to me, I'm just like, you're dumb victim. You're dumb cops. I can't believe you actually caught him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very 60s thriller for sure. And it's, yeah. So the cops barge in. He's there basically going to strangle her.
Yeah.
And they shoot him. They shoot Leo Kroll. And he crashes through the window and falls a few stories below to the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Which kind of was a surprising ending to me. I mean, I knew he was either going to get killed or... But to me, I feel like the whole episode is... It's slow. It's all about his performance. So I was kind of like, okay, that's cool. I like this ending.
Yeah, me too.
It was rushed and it was kind of a surprise ending. I enjoyed it. It was a little bit unexpected based on what you watched, you know, the first hour. So
Yeah.
And then that final shot is just the end. He's there dead, bleeding on the sidewalk with a little doll next to him.
Broken doll.
A broken doll. Yeah. And it's just a great shot. Like you said, this, the opening and the ending are very strong.
Yeah.
Visually.
I did like it.
Do you have anything else you want to bring up?
I mean, you already mentioned the milk, which is just absurd.
Yeah.
Like, they spend so much time drinking box milk. Yeah. It's just silly. The only other thing was his, I don't know, lab partner.
Oh, Thelma? Yeah. Thelma. I liked her.
Yeah. And I thought, like, I was like, oh, hello, 60s movie with a black woman scientist. Good for you. Like,
and her scene's great, too. There is a scene where she's talking to him. And, you know, the killer's out loose. And I think this was probably something that maybe the screenwriter Ballinger wanted to include, was how women in real life were handling the real Boston Strangler. You know, they're kind of arming themselves and preparing themselves. And she starts saying stuff like, I'd stab, if you know, if the Strangler came up to me, I'd stab him with my hair. And she pulls out her long hairpin.
Right.
I'd stab him with this. And then she talks about her friends like booby trapping their homes and carrying acid in their purses. I'm like, oh, they should show scenes of that.
I know.
Accidentally like throwing acid in some guy who's walking up, like,
oh, that would have been so good.
Picking a leaf off of her shoulder or something. Like,
you could have had that instead of, you know, you could take out one of the strangulations from Leo Kroll and substitute it in with another, like a fake out woman getting stalked. And then she accidentally injures some guy who just happened to be like, oh, hey, you had a bee on your shoulder or something.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Like something like that.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
But yeah, her having that lab assistant, that was cool. That was surprising too, like you said.
Yeah. I think the only other thing, kind of getting back to the strangulations, and this is just a pet peeve of mine in movies, is how quickly the women die when being strangled.
Yeah.
And I know you can't sit there and show someone being strangled for how long it actually takes to strangle someone and kill them, but it's literally like 3 seconds. And I'm like, okay, they're not, no, that's not how people die. That it takes a very long time to strangle someone to death.
Yeah.
Speaking from experience.
It's the magic of Victor Buono's strong hands. Just no.
I mean, I know they're probably not going to add in like a neck snap sound effect to something like this, because that would probably be too brutal for something like this. But if he's just strangling them, it takes longer than that. It's just a pet peeve of mine in the movie. And not even just like older movies like this, but even modern movies. I'm like, oh my God, they're not fucking dead yet.
You like the realistic kills.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, the Strangler overall, I mean, would you liked
it
for the most part?
Yeah, I did. I gave it 3.5. I liked it. It's probably not one I would revisit, because when it's generally, when a movie is mostly relying on performance, I don't tend to revisit those very much. But I did really like it. I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah.
It's a good pick.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a basic thriller. No real surprises. You know right away Buono's the Strangler. Mm-hmm. So you kind of are just expecting for the end. I was thinking, because because Buono's so captivating, and I did enjoy the quick progression of the story. I mean, I think some of the kills are a little spread out, but, and I kept thinking like maybe a remake of this, but then I was like, no, I mean, you're going to be hard pressed to find anybody as good as, you know, Buono is as Leo Kroll.
Right. I mean, if you had a really good movie about the Boston Strangler and had like the scene that we were talking about where you had some fake out victims or attackers or something
add
like that. That might be interesting, but I don't necessarily think that you need to remake this.
Yeah,
I think it's good where it stands.
Yeah, there was a Boston Strangler movie made in 1968. Tony Curtis played the killer. I haven't seen it.
I'd let him strangle me.
Also had George Kennedy and Henry Fonda in it. So yeah, double feature pick with the Strangler. What do you have, Erica?
Another 60s serial killer movie.
Nice.
I'm going with, and spoiler, I have this on the list for a future episode. And I think I mentioned it to you because Kino has a Blu-ray of it.
Oh, I bought it.
Okay. So they might be sold out of it by now. Might be able to still find it on Amazon. But it's The Psychopath from 1966, directed by the great Freddie Francis.
Yes.
Starring Patrick Weimark. And it's about a series of brutal murders in which a doll of each victim is found at the scene. And the son of the woman who purchased the dolls and a room full of tons of others, he is the prime suspect. So yeah, I think it works well for, like, you know, the doll aspect and just like the time period and a we mainly follow the detective who's trying to track it down. So it's better in that aspect than the psychopath. So the performance is more focused on not the villain so much as it is Patrick Weimark. But
okay. And they're not, the cops are smarter in this, in the psychopath.
Smarter, but not like, still yeah. not likable. I mean, they're cops. Come on.
Right, right. Okay.
So yeah, Psychopath 1966 would be my double feature pick. I don't see that it is streaming anywhere right now. So I would, if you have the chance to, definitely pick up the Kino Blu-ray of it. It's got a commentary by Troy Howarth on it. So when we do cover that, gonna see if he can make it back and guest on that episode with us.
Awesome. Yeah, when you had posted that, I picked it up right away. Cool. So.
Did you get it for $5?
I did.
Sick.
It was when they were doing their whole closeout, like get rid of old titles.
Nice. What about you? Double feature.
So I watched a lot of films with Victor Buono, and mm-hmm. I wanted a double feature of Buono.
Okay.
And because I want more people to, you know about him and his name and watch more of his movies. And while this one isn't my favorite, I think it fits really well with The Strangler. It's an Italian horror called The Mad Butcher from 1971, also known as Meat is Meat. That's a quote from the movie, directed by Guido Zerli. Like The Strangler, Victor Buono plays the title role. He's the mad butcher. His name is Otto Lehmann, and he's the best butcher in Vienna. But he was locked in a madhouse for 3 years due to slapping a shopper with 3 pounds of liver.
That's fun.
So, you know, he's released. He returns to his butcher shop, which is his only passion in life. He has a wife who he does not like at all, and he kills her. And he's, you know, fearing that he'll be sent to prison or even the asylum again. He, you know, and he's the best butcher in Vienna. He's like, okay. He decides to make her disappear, telling himself, whispering to himself, quote, meat is meat. So he starts making sausage out of her. You know, this town's people just love it. And he then proceeds to kill others who are suspicious of him. Mm-hmm. So it's short. The Mad Butcher's short. It's weirdly edited. It reuses a lot of scenes as flashbacks or just like characters, you know, remembering stuff. And it has this whimsical music that kind of leans harder into the dark, like a dark comedy than mm-hmm. a horror. But there's murder, there is horror elements, and Buono, his kind of, his style of killing is strangling and neck snapping.
Okay.
So he's the strangler in The Mad Butcher before he butchers him. And in the end, you know, this isn't really a spoiler because it's an early movie, but he meets his fate in a very similar fashion as the strangler. Mm-hmm. So you can find this on YouTube under Meat is Meat. But
make sure you put the year, because I imagine that there'll be a bunch of like,
just Google man meat. yeah. Meat is Meat 1971, or Meat is Meat. I think Victor Buono came up, mm-hmm. But yeah, I would go ahead and watch The Mad Butcher, then The Strangler in that order.
Okay. I think I would probably start with The Strangler and then end with The Psychopath. Even though I feel like The Psychopath is a little bit of a stronger film, and usually you lead with the bigger one, but I like to end with a better one sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, the one that packs a little bit more of a punch, so.
Yeah, I enjoy The Strangler more than The Mad Butcher, but some other people might not.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Okay, well, what are we doing for our next episode?
Okay, so next episode, and I'll get into my next pick right after this. But next week, we are going to have our bonus episode for our annual Junesploitation bonus episode. We're going to be going through all of our picks for this year's F This Movie Challenge. And that's going to be a long one. So, you know, strap in for that. We're going to each have 30 picks. So that's 60 movies to talk about very briefly. I'm not bringing extra this time. It's been a very lean Junesploitation for me this year. But
good.
Yeah, I know. I say that every year, and then I still end up mentioning other ones. But I think I really mean it this year.
Okay.
I'm going to try. So, and that's not just going to be horror movies. That's going to be tons of different genres, action movies, blaxploitation.
Comedies.
DTV.
All sorts of stuff.
Oh, you know, I'm faring well with the comedies this year. So yeah, be sure to check that out. You can check out fthismovie.com for more information about the challenge. It's by the time this comes out, obviously we're going to be at the end of the month. So I'm a little late to jump in for that, but they do it every year. So, and we do a similar challenge in October, different category for each month for Horror Gives Back. So you can look out for that as well. Okay. So then after that, Lance, it's time to get stupid.
Yes.
Italian style.
I'm always down for Italian stupid.
All right. So Ruggero Deodato, famed director, Cannibal Holocaust, Cut and Run, House on the Edge of the Park, many others.
Yes.
Directed the erotic thriller Dial Help in 1988, which currently has 412 views on Letterboxd. This is starring the beautiful Charlotte Lewis and is about a woman who dials a wrong number and ends up tapping into a malevolent energy, which takes a fancy to her and begins killing anyone who it perceives as a threat. So it's basically a killer phone movie.
Yes, I love this.
All right. So, and I have to share like one of the reviews from the people that I follow on Letterboxd because it just made me giggle. He wrote, other directors, you can't make an erotic thriller about haunted telephones. Ruggero Deodato, hold my J&B. So Dial Help was on YouTube, but as of now, the English dub is gone. If you speak Spanish, it's on there under the title Telefono Mortal, but it is on Daily Motion in two parts. So I'll put those links in show notes for you to click on. However, whoever uploaded that one did it backwards. So you're going to have to deal with backwards credits and like signs being backwards when you watch it. So sorry, I know I'm always the one who picks the ones that are difficult to watch.
But just hold up a mirror and watch it.
So sorry about that. But I mean, I feel like we've covered a number of movies, not just in our Blu-ray wish list episodes that have gotten releases. So hopefully in a year from now, this will have a release and then someone will come looking for this episode and find us and find that movie. So apologies, but you know, don't be mad at me. Be mad at the person who took it off YouTube or who reported it and made it disappear from YouTube. So Dial Help, 1988, next episode, directed by Ruggero Deodato.
Goblin score.
Yes.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. All the good
Deodato
stuff.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing I love about it too. And I actually have one that I'm really excited about in my back pocket for Giallo January from another
Deodato?
No, from another Italian director though.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I'm excited for that one too.
Awesome.
But that's a ways away. So next week, Junesploitation, following that, Dial Help. If you're not already, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. I am on Letterboxd, Twitter, and Instagram at Hex Massacre.
I'm on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at L Scheibe.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you back next week for our Junesploitation bonus episode.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about a thousand cats would look like?
It's called Night of a Thousand Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!